The number of heroin overdose deaths in Iowa increased sixfold from 2007 to 2013. This hour, what lawmakers are doing about Iowa's heroin epidemic. I'm Joyce Russell. This is River to River on Iowa Public Radio. This hour, we'll learn about State House proposals meant to decrease heroin overdose deaths. Along with lawmakers, I'll talk with a mother who lost her son to an overdose back in 2011.
If we had equipped family, friends, and lay people with the overdose reversal drug naloxone, he may very well be alive today.
That's coming up in the second half, but first, what did and didn't make it through Funnel Week? Join our conversation after this news from NPR. Good afternoon. I'm Joyce Russell. I'm here in the Law Library at the State Capitol. I have two State House reporters with me, Bill Petrosky from the Des Moines Register and Kay Henderson from Radio Iowa. They're here to talk with us about what happened last week with Funnel Week. That is the self-imposed deadline for that legislators have to bring bills out of committee in at least one chamber. We know from experience that this is not hard and fast. Bills that fail to make the funnel can sometimes be revived. And bills that did make the funnel sometimes need too much work to gain final passage. But it is an indication of the bills that have at least some substantial interest behind them. So we hope you'll join the conversation. Give us a call at 866-780-9100. Tweet us at IPR Talk. Message us on Facebook. Or email us at rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. Hello, Bill. Thanks for joining us today.
Glad to be here.
And hi, Kay. Thanks for being with us.
Greetings.
We're going to start by talking about some of the bills that did not make it through Funnel Week. One of them was one of the priorities of the NAACP, which has been up at the Capitol lobbying for things that they think will help address the disproportionate number of African Americans in Iowa prison. One of their concerns was mandatory minimum sentencing, and that bill did not make it through the legislature. Kay, in addition to the NAACP, where is the impetus for this coming from, and is it likely that it could get added to another bill this session?
It's possible. I don't believe it to be likely. There were other bills which survived, including legislation that dealt with the secrecy of juvenile court records. And there's also another bill that deals with actually enhancing the time that people who are domestic abusers must spend behind bars. Currently, they get time off for good behavior. This legislation would cut that. And it also would require them, while they are behind bars, to participate in a batterer's treatment program. Currently, if someone is convicted of domestic abuse, they can go and sit in prison and not participate in that program and just do their time and come out. There are some other things that supporters might like to add to that legislation. There was, as you and your listeners know, a governor's task force that met to discuss ways to change to effect sentencing reform. And perhaps one of the most important ways to do that does not actually require legislation. The courts have decided to try to make changes in the way juries are selected, to have more minorities part of the jury pool and serving on juries. And there are advocates who think that that may be a significant move that actually does not require legislative action.
If I can just jump in, what this really gets to is something that you've seen discussed both statewide and nationally. A lot of the presidential candidates were talking about this, and that's criminal justice reform. There was this huge push in the 1980s, 1990s to put more and more people in prison, the idea being that if you're behind bars, you can't go out and commit a crime. Iowa's prison population is over 8,000 people. That's triple of what it was when Terry Branstad became governor. He oversaw the construction of three new state prisons, a major expansion of the prison system. Now he wants to downsize state government, and he recognizes that, hey, one of the ways that you can go about doing this is by having a smarter approach to putting people in prison, mandatory minimum sentencing, a lot of that has to deal with that. Smarter sentencing for people rather than just saying one size fits all for all crimes.
The secrecy of juvenile court records, that was specifically in the governor's agenda that he announced. And I sat in on one of the subcommittees on that. I don't know if you were there, but I was surprised at the vigorousness of that debate. I mean, they started by talking to, you know, advocates for youth, saying this is, you need to give these young people a chance.
Sure.
But then the criticism kicked in from
the prosecutors.
Right. And the newspaper folks.
Because it would open up Iowa's open records law to make that particular change.
That's right.
The other group that are interested in that are people who do background checks as required for sensitive positions, working in preschools, working in K through 12 schools. Those folks think that they need to have access to information if someone as a juvenile is convicted of a sex crime.
If I could just jump back, though, a lot of this has to do with disproportionate incarceration. Iowa, about one quarter of all of the people in Iowa's prisons are African Americans. The state state's black population is only 3.33%. So it's almost 10 times the rate of the state's population disproportionately is black in the state's prison system. And I think most people agree that, gosh, why is that happening? And a lot of these things point to ways to try to address that.
And there is a racial profiling bill that is
there. That's still
Iowa,
alive.
And that it's still alive. Iowa is, I believe, Bill, one of 19 states which doesn't have some sort of law that addresses the issue. And the governor has said that he is not against keeping more data to identify whether there are problems in law enforcement agencies around the state. I'm not sure that he believes there needs to be legislation in there.
Right, and there's a lot of concern among law enforcement that this will be used as a bludgeon against them.
Speaking of law enforcement, another issue that failed to meet the deadline last week were a couple of bills that had to do with police body cameras. This has been in the news because of a police shooting in Burlington. The family took their case to the Public Information Board. This is still pending. But one of the bills would have said it should be a public record. A police body camera should be a public record if it shows the use of force by police. I mean, that getting directly to the Burlington police shooting. But Kay, I understand there's some support for this even by the cities, if not the police departments themselves.
This is an interesting issue. I heard the mayor of Council Bluffs argue for body cameras. Because he said that juries have begun to expect there to be some sort of video evidence presented at trial because they watch Law and Order, they watch CSI, they watch all of these programs on television, and they are now programmed to expect some sort of video evidence to be presented at trial, and that's what body cameras do. Some police agencies will tell you it's a defense for themselves because it will show how they interact with the public, in addition to advocates who say it will show when there are abuses by police. The other interesting thing about this is the expense of it and just the mammoth size of the video files and who pays for storing it. How long do you have to keep that video? Do you have to keep it 5 years? Do you have to keep it 1 year? Who decides which videos are kept and which aren't? This is a really new area, not just in Iowa, but nationally. And I think this will be a discussion that will be ongoing for several legislative sessions.
I think that it's viewed as such a deep subject. There's so many aspects of it, like for example, if there's an incident, should somebody be able to go in and immediately request a copy of that video? As you know, that's been a huge topic of discussion in Illinois as a result of shootings and that type of thing. So, I think they felt that it was so overwhelming they didn't want to just handle it all of a sudden, and let's do some study and have some interim studies to address it.
Bill, there were speed limit bills again this year. Is that just always going to be a a perennial? What kind of stars would have to align to raise Iowa's speed limit?
Oh, boy, I think that's one that they know is going to be a hit back home with a lot of folks who drive faster than the speed limit. Anybody who drives in Iowa, you know, right now, I think if you talk with the DOT, the actual speed, the average speed that people are driving on Iowa's interstate freeways, it's actually like 72, 73 miles an hour. And if you drive on I-80, you can I can assure you that a lot of people are driving 80, go over and onto I-29 out in western Iowa, and gosh, they think that they're in South Dakota. You know, so this is a popular idea, but the votes, Josh Burns will tell you, he threw it out there, he tried to lasso enough votes, and they just weren't there, so he said, let's drop it.
One of the reasons that it lacked the votes was Republicans, who are a little bit, you know, still have a sour taste in their mouth after the gas tax was raised a dime a gallon about this time last year, balked at the idea of spending, you know, a few hundred thousand dollars to change all of the speed limit signs on Interstate 80, Interstate 35, Interstate 29. And then there was an alternate proposal that would have raised the speed limit on two-lane highways right. as well. And that just added to the price tag and added to the heartburn among those people who thought, yeah, we raised the speed limit to fix roads, and so we're going to spend the money on signs.
Right. Right. And it's important to point out that the DOT, which didn't take a position one way or another, they pointed out, hey, look, after the, we raised the speed limit in the Vilsack administration, 70 miles per hour, the number of deaths and injuries immediately went up.
There is an interesting transportation-related issue that's still alive. There is a bill in the House that would no longer require a front plate on your vehicle. And that is an interesting debate, which pits some law enforcement people against the owners of classic cars and really high-end vehicles, which no longer actually have something on the front of the vehicle for a license plate.
One thing I learned from the speed limit debate was not only would they have to pay money to put up the change the signs, but they also have to change the pass the no passing lanes, because if you're driving faster, then that the amount of no passing time you need is different. So I mean, it's
right.
more complicated than you think. Okay, well, we're going to move on to some bills that did not die in the funnel, and what would you like Iowa lawmakers to focus on for the rest of the session? Give us a call at 866-780-9100. Well, some of the bills that were surprising that passed, and some of them are questionable, as we said, for likely to win final passage. Medical marijuana is one of those. Bill, were you surprised that a medical marijuana bill made the funnel?
Yes, I was. And the reason was that I think Speaker Uffmeyer had made it very clear. She's a nurse cardiology practitioner, very knowledgeable about medicine, and she had flatly said over and over heading into the session, we are not going to take this bill up, period. And then what happened was something that I think surprised a lot of people, was how many people filled up the Capitol with to discuss this bill and many other bills over the past week or two. And that's something that clearly had had an impact on legislators.
This reminds me of what happened when Iowa legislators actually passed the law that decriminalized possession of cannabis oil for people mm-hmm. and the treatment of intractable epilepsy. That passed over the objections of the House Speaker, as we all recall, although, albeit like something like 2 o'clock in the morning.
In the middle of the night.
In the middle of the night. In the middle of the night. So, A, it's not, out of, the realm of possibility that there may be a coalition of members in the Iowa House who will overrule, if you will, their House Speaker and get that bill passed. It's also almost a generational issue. You had people like Zach Nunn and Peter County who were advocates of this and trying to craft a compromise that is more succinct and deals with only three conditions, whereas the version that did pass the Iowa Senate last year dealt with a whole host of chronic conditions.
Including things like PTSD.
Exactly.
Yes.
Well, I thought it was interesting that there it was a very convincing vote in the Commerce Committee, and I happened to be on the elevator with conservative Republican representative. He had voted for the bill. And I said, "Wow, why'd you vote for that bill?" And he said, "Well, I felt a lot more comfortable when they scaled it back. Initially, there were, as you say, a long number of conditions and also many more manufacturing and distribution points." Kay, comment on that. What's the politics behind it? It's okay to have two distribution points, but not 12.
It's an interesting, a bit of psychology. It's a little bit like, you know, saying we're going to give you a glass of beer instead of a full pitcher. There is a desire among people, given the stories that they hear from people who have intractable epilepsy, people who had ulcerative colitis. They all came to the State House and told tragic stories about having tried every other prescription medication, and they consider medical marijuana to be their last resort. And many of these people could be at the end of their life. And that's a very compelling message to legislators of either party.
But the big concern here is that it's going to turn into a recreational marijuana bill, that it would become the gateway. And if you talk with some folks from some states that do have medical marijuana bills, well, gosh, if you have a backache, what you do is you go. I read a story about a guy who went to an obstetrical doctor. A man went to an obstetrical doctor and said, "I have a backache," and he gave him a prescription for medical marijuana. That's the concern.
But the interesting thing about that particular story is that we have a case study on that. We have Representative Clell Bodler, who went to the state of California and in a newsworthy way, got a prescription for hemorrhoids and came back and bragged about how he had gotten a prescription for hemorrhoids and talked about how this just shows this is so ridiculous. And then a few years later, he was one of the people spearheading the effort to decriminalize possession of cannabis oil because he had been moved by the stories of the mothers of children with intractable epilepsy.
We have a caller on the line. Jonathan says is a classic car owner, and so he has an opinion about the front license plate bill. Jonathan, are you with us? No, I guess he just made a comment that he would like to see exceptions made for the front license plate bill.
Right, and I, talking with Josh Burns, he says that's one of the most likely things to get an exception.
Okay, Nick is on the line from Des Moines, and he wants to discuss a bill that would expand custody. Nick, what's your question?
I guess I don't know what my question necessarily is. I just wanted to make sure the public is aware of there was two bills. Ken Reiser produced one, and Norlin Mumsey produced another. And to my understanding, I think they both survived the funnel, which are meant to try and take away some of that fight from divorces at the get-go by having, when you go into a divorce, you would automatically start at a 50-50 legal and physical custody share point unless there were justifiable grounds to prove why one parent was not fit. It just seems right now in the current divorce system that as soon as you file, you're going to war and putting those kids in the middle, and that parental alienation begins to take root, and then all the other consequences that come about through the mental disorders we're putting on. Divorce is actually one of the leading causes of PTSD because it creates it through both spouses as well as the children. And so if we can take out some of that fight and just create more, again, equality and let parents be parents, then there's no reason they shouldn't be if the bad spouses can be great parents.
Okay. Okay, Nick, thanks a lot for your question. What are going to be the arguments against that bill?
Well, I'm not sure what all the arguments would be against that. Anything, but I can tell you this, any time that you're talking about that kind of a law, that's the kind of thing, that's a classic example of something that typically results in an interim study, where the legislatures say, this is so controversial, this is so heated, it's so complex, that what we'll do is we'll shove it aside, we're going to study it. We want to sit down with all the parties in order to reach an agreement, reach some kind of a consensus that we can, all parties can say that we can move forward on. Sometimes some of these kinds of things, as we well know, takes two or three years for it to get addressed.
Picking up on the children theme, Joyce, there was a bill which died, which would have raised the age to 21 for buying cigarettes and other tobacco products. That died. But a bill that survived would require high schools at sporting events to have a licensed athletic trainer or a doctor on hand to deal with concussions. As we've all known and seen, that has become quite an issue in the NFL, and even you see research that concussions are a huge issue among girls who play soccer. So this was an interesting debate among legislators, and schools are being put on notice. I don't know that that bill will actually pass,
but
schools are now being put on notice. You really do have to pay attention to concussions.
And you're exactly right. I think there's a good chance that won't pass both chambers. But the fact is it really raised the level of scrutiny for all schools. My understanding is I think Senator Bowman, who discussed that bill, said something like 48% of all athletic events are now covered by medical professionals. But what about the ones that aren't? That's right. What about practices, and what about – this is only for varsity events too.
And yeah. It also raised questions about whether there are even enough athletic trainers in the state to cover every Friday
That's
night
right.
football game. And also, of course, unfunded mandates for schools is always the issue.
My understanding is that it's of particular concern in the small rural schools.
The other kid issue was a bill about tanning beds. Last year, there was legislation which would require parental approval for anyone under the age of 19. That's been scaled back to folks under the age of 17. There's some pushback from legislators who say, you know, leave this up to parents and their kids. There's others who make the alternative argument. The tanning bed industry has even been involved in this issue. So that's an interesting one to watch, particularly during prom season.
Right. Well, we're just about out of time, but maybe each of you could comment on prospects for a fireworks bill this year.
Oh, I think the potential is very good. I mean, the fact of the matter is if you let it – this was approved by the House last session. If you just brought it up to a straight up or down vote – on the Senate floor, it would pass, period. The votes are clearly there, but the issue is that there are some people within the Senate Democratic Caucus who just don't think it's a good idea, think it's very bad public policy to allow this. And so what's passed so far is, as I understand it, is a bill that would allow fireworks, but a community city council or county would need to opt in to do it. So most places it would be illegal. And that's viewed as a poison pill. They don't want – the people who are in favor of fireworks don't want to proceed. So if it does come to a vote, there would be a vote on the Senate floor to amend that to just essentially let most communities have fireworks.
I'm not sure when this may burst on the scene, but it could take off into the stratosphere at some point if Iowans start clamoring for more fireworks access than they already have.
Okay. Well, thank you for a lively discussion about events at the state capitol. Bill Petrosky with the Des Moines Register and Kay Henderson with Radio Iowa. Thanks to both of you, and we'll be back. Thanks for being with us. This is River to River, live from the Law Library at the State Capitol. I'm Joyce Russell. Thanks for joining us today. Our topic this half hour is a number of pieces of legislation that have to do with opioid overdose. These are ways of addressing the state's heroin epidemic. Give us a call at 800-780-9100 if you'd like to join the conversation. Tweet us at IPR Talk, message us on Facebook, or email us at rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. We have on the line from Davenport, Kim Brown. She lost her son, Andy Lamp, to a heroin overdose back in 2011. She is now an advocate for some of the changes in state law that she believes might have saved her son's life. Kim, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Joyce.
What do you know about the details of your son's death?
The details. Well, he died May 25th, 2011 of an accidental heroin overdose.
And I understand that he was not alone when he died, and that's what's behind what you're wanting the legislature to do. Tell us about that.
Absolutely. And when my son overdosed and died, there was another person there in the house with him. And as you know, I've been a big advocate to get naloxone into the hands of family, friends, and peers of active drug users so that we can stop these needless deaths from either prescription drug or heroin overdose.
So you're imagining a scenario where you and the people your son was with would have had this drug that they could have used in this emergency?
Well, you know, certainly they could have had the drug. There were other states. I know New Jersey, and I also know Maryland. Both were very busy on overdose prevention and awareness back in 2011, 2012, and they had already passed laws allowing the overdose rescue drug to be dispensed to EMTs, well, you know, EMS, law enforcement, and family, friends, and peers of drug users.
And so there are two versions of this legislation. One would give both the general public and emergency personnel access to this drug. Another bill would be just for emergency personnel. How important is it that and there seems to be some broad support for that, how important is it that the general public also have access to it?
Well, I think it's important because if you look at the latest CDC report that came out, I think, in June of 2015, you can see that the most reversals or rescues using naloxone were done by lay people. In fact, 82.8% of reported reversals were carried out by people who actually use drugs. As opposed to that, in the last 2 years in North Carolina, 52 law enforcement departments carried naloxone and had 39 reversals. North Carolina Harm Reduction trained and equipped lay people with naloxone, and they had 2,123 reversals in the same two-year period. And if I might add, people that use drugs typically are not going to dial 911 for help because they fear arrest and punishment. Should they be followed up with medical treatment once they're reversed with naloxone? Yes, they should. I'm a registered nurse, and I certainly believe that. However, if they don't call law enforcement and other folks around them have naloxone, they're going to save their life.
Well, you're making reference to another proposed piece of legislation, and that is what they call a Good Samaritan law.
Mm-hmm.
And that's so that if, let's say your son was with another drug user, that other drug user would have been afraid to call for help. And so the Good Samaritan law would give limited freedom from prosecution for that person. How important would a law like that be?
Extremely important. It would bridge trust with folks in the community that are using drugs with law enforcement. It would provide immunity for simple possession, being under the influence and having paraphernalia on them. So it would be a step in building trust, and in that regard, we could start saving some lives.
Okay, well, we're going to bring a couple of lawmakers on to talk about some of this proposed legislation. Representative Jared Klein and Representative Kevin Kinney. Kevin Kinney, a Democrat, Representative Klein, a Republican. We'll start with you, Representative Kinney, because the Senate has passed a more wide-ranging bill that would put this antidote into a wide range of hands, including the general public, and would also enact the Good Samaritan provision of this. How important do you think this bill to make the antidote more available? How much good is that actually going to do?
I think it's going to come into... It'll make a big difference in maybe trying to save some people. I do have a problem with giving someone immunity for just calling to law enforcement or first responders. And the other problem is the people that do have or have OD'd on heroin, I've investigated a couple cases where there is naloxone in the person's system and they did not receive help or they did not go to get help after they were given naloxone and they eventually wound up dying. So there's a... I do feel that it's useful, but it's not going to be a cure-all.
Right. So maybe you would like to see something in there that would, I don't know what, mandate treatment for this person who's just had his life saved so that it you know, the same thing just doesn't happen again?
Well, how are you going to mandate the treatment after they're dead? I mean, you're going
to No. I mean, if you've used the antidote, it's saved that person's life. And some people are concerned that, okay, you do that once, but what keeps them from just repeating the incident?
The other issue, I think, a bigger issue in this is you could have someone that is actually a very large drug dealer that may be the person that made this phone call, and you're then granting them immunity from prosecution. And it's just not a simple possession. There's more to it than just the possession of a controlled substance. It could be you have to look at each situation on their own, and I just don't want to give a blanket immunity.
Okay, so I was under the impression that the Senate bill did include this immunity from prosecution for the bystander.
One Senate bill did.
The other did not. Okay. Well, Representative Klein, what arguments would you add to the arguments against this Good Samaritan provision?
Well, when you're talking about arguments, I think you got two legislators here that in a lot of ways agree on this issue. And, of course, it's nice that we do also represent the same area because we're coming from some of the same things. The Good Samaritan law and the general public use does definitely give me a couple heartburn issues, one of which is people using it as that safety mechanism that they're going to push the limit, they're going to try to get a little bit more high because they might just have this safety mechanism sitting there in their back pocket. That causes me some real concern because that seems to be a driver among the people that do use these drugs is they want to get a bigger and better high each time they go after it. So there's some definite concern there of using it as a safety measure, people not knowing that they need to get people to the hospital. This isn't going to be a fix-all. This is really more of a delaying sort of an issue until you get them to real professional medical help. So the Good Samaritan aspect, Senator Kenney's right in a lot of ways. That does provide some serious possibilities for abuse there. So that's the middle ground we're trying to find between the two chambers, which is why it's kind of a hard one to nail down on which bill are we talking about, which amendment are we talking about, because we're trying to find that middle ground to be able to get this product out there in the countryside where we have people that are vulnerable and far away from medical professionals.
Well, Kim, what's your reaction to the hesitation that the Good Samaritan aspect or even the distribution of the antidote could actually encourage more drug use?
First of all, there's quite a bit of difference between simple possession, paraphernalia, and being under the influence. And I would be the first one to say that I would never condone or encourage drug trafficking. We're talking about two different things. And I believe that if it's simple and somebody's calling for help, there should be some limited immunity to prosecution there, because otherwise the person that they're calling about is going to die. Or the other scenario is they're going to say, why bother calling? We're going to get arrested. And they run, and they leave that overdose victim laying to die. And we know of a whole lot of those situations across Iowa. Secondly, I have talked to active drug users. The last thing they want to be is reversed with naloxone. It's very uncomfortable. They're put into immediate withdrawals. And I can assure you that they're not going to sit around with heroin in one hand and naloxone in their back pocket and get as high as they can. They couldn't reverse themselves. They'd have to set up a situation where somebody in the room with them would reverse them in the event that they overdose. That's not how active drug users think. They don't want to overdose. They don't want naloxone used on them, and they do not want to die.
Okay, well, we're going to bring Wayne Germain on now. He's the chief of police for the Cedar Rapids Police Department. Thanks for joining us, Chief Germain.
Sure.
Okay. Tell us about your experience with overdose cases as an officer, and what's your take on the Good Samaritan law?
Well, I've been listening to the conversation, and I think all the parties have extremely relevant, pertinent points of view. My experience is I've witnessed firsthand from being on the scene just here in Cedar Rapids of a woman who had overdosed, and she was by all accounts dead until the EMS providers arrived on the scene and gave her Narcan, and she was up and talking within 10 minutes. I mean, it was really amazing. From a position here as chief, and I've been speaking with my colleagues from all over the country, especially those from Maryland, where I was from, and also from the New England area, where they have really a serious problem with heroin overdoses and related deaths. And I know many of these jurisdictions have allowed law enforcement to carry Narcan and administer it. It's very safe to administer, even to individuals who are overdosing on something else other than heroin or an opioid substance. So if an officer arrives on the scene and someone is unconscious and the officer is not able to determine what they have overdosed from, if he or she was to administer Narcan, it's not going to have any adverse impact or effects on the individual. However, if they are overdosing on heroin or an opioid, it does have an immediate positive impact. So I've heard the points about not granting overall blanket immunity, and I agree with that. I think there does need to be some review and study to get something that will fit in Iowa and satisfy all the concerns. But the most relevant point is saving lives. And I know Senator Kinney is a former law enforcement officer, and I know he values the sanctity of human life, and that's why we've taken the oath, and that's one of the areas that we're trying to do here in Iowa, and that's why I'm in favor of providing law enforcement officers with Narcan.
Well, let's turn to that other piece of this then. How many people should have access to these antidotes? There's one bill from the Senate that would give it to the general public. The bill in the House, one of the bills in the House, would limit it to law enforcement. So, Representative Klein, what are your arguments against making this more readily available?
Well, actually, the bill that limits it to just law enforcement, I believe Senator Kinney has a bill as well that does that. So we have companion bills in both chambers that get it to those first responders. And I also want to quick add in that we seem to be focusing a lot on the people that use heroin and those sort of drugs, but this is also something that can be useful when we have our elderly folks out there that are on a lot of these sort of prescribed drugs that sometimes get confused, maybe take a second dose, and we have to clarify this gets used in those situations as well. So I want to make sure we're painting this in the most broad picture we can, because that was a story shared with me just this morning from a colleague that affected their an elderly person.
Okay, well, briefly then, what is your main argument against making this antidote drug available to the general public and not just emergency personnel?
The general public issue is going to be one that we got to find that middle ground on. I'm not sure how we get there yet. At the very minimum, I want to get it into law enforcement, first responders, public safety people's hands. And then down the road, I think we can start to get closer to figuring out how we get it to the right people. There are certain family members most definitely should be included in this, but how do we narrowly tailor it so that we're not using it out there with the drug dealers and the bad actors? That's the challenge we face, and that's what Senator Kevin and Senator Kinney and I have been working on, is how do we find the middle ground between the two chambers.
We have a caller on the line. Sylvia is a recovered heroin addict. Sylvia, are you with us? You're from the Quad Cities. Thanks for joining us.
I am, and you're wrong. I am not recovered. I am in the process of recovering. I've only been sober a couple of months. Here's the thing. The gentleman said he didn't want the antidote and until he found the middle ground. I assure you, these users are using as much drugs as they can get their hands on, regardless of whether there's an antidote or not. The proof in that is that there are deaths left and right. It doesn't matter. And you're saying, well, we need to give this to the family or support system. Do you really believe these addicts are telling their family that they're addicted to heroin? They're not telling their families. My family didn't know until they were broke and they wondered where all their money went. It's a terrible, terrible thing. There is no middle ground.
Okay, Sylvia, thank you for your call. Senator Kinney?
We also have to look at the people that are using prescription medications. As Representative Klein had stated, we have had cases where people have overdosed and died on prescription medications because they were confused. They were an elderly type person. Representative Klein is correct. We had companion legislation. The companion legislation that I had brought forward did add that family members and or treatment facilities could also have access to the Narcan. So we're not only looking at the heroin aspect of it, we're looking at the prescription medication aspect of this also. And that's why, you know, they came to me and they sat down and explained to me that there are people out here that are accidentally taking too much heroin, or not heroin, prescription medication, Oxycontin, whatever it may be, and they are also overdosing. And that's where I decided that, yes, I am going to bend a little bit and would allow it to be prescribed by a physician to a family member.
Well, what's your take on what our caller had to say, sort of contradicting what Representative Klein said, that if you make this too readily available, it will end up in the hands of dealers and have a way of encouraging drug use? What's your take on that?
I think that I was on the heroin task force for 2 years, and people are trying to ultimately get that ultimate high. And to me, I'm worried that if it's in the drug dealer or the drug user's hands, that we're going to have more people possibly dying from overdoses because of that.
Okay. Well, Representative Klein, there's another related bill that you have been working on. And this has to do with prescription drugs, not with heroin. Tamper-proof pills is the subject of that. Tell us what that would do.
Yeah, tamper-proof painkillers. This is a relatively newer topic in the last few years that we've been working on, and it is somewhat attached to this because they both deal with opioids. But right now, this piece of legislation is aimed at directing insurance companies to cover certain tamper-proof painkillers. So when a doctor has somebody that's there, just had back surgery, they're likely to go on to a heavy-duty painkiller, but this person doesn't want to get re-addicted, or the doctor maybe helps identify that they're a high risk for addiction. This would give them an opportunity to get that tamper-proof medication. and then in turn the insurance company would have to cover it, which is where the hang up is on who pays for it. But the generic drugs are starting to come on the market now, so the price will be going down, but ultimately this is an issue that when the doctor and the patient come to the conclusion they need something that has a less ability for them to get addicted to, that we get that provided.
I've got a little bit of a problem with it because you can go on the internet and find out how to get around it. You bake it, you put it in a water soluble, and then you can inject it.
Okay. Thank you for each of you for joining us today. Kim Brown, Chief Wayne Germain, Representative Klein, and Senator Kinney. Thanks all of you for joining us today. River to River is produced by Emily Woodbury, Lindsay Moon, and Claire Roth. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. Production assistance today from Dennis Reese, John Pimble, and Tony Denner. Podcasting and on-demand audio of River to River are available at iowapublicradio.org. We welcome your comments and questions. Contact us at any time at rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. I'm Joyce Russell, River to River, a production of Iowa Public Radio News.